supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And as we are sandwiched between the holidays of sweet potatoes right now, we have a question of the week about the ornamental sweet potato vine. And can you grow your own from those weird little tubers it makes in your pots and hanging baskets? We'll have the answer after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marilyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Marilyn. How are you?
I am great.
Wow, that's exceptional. Where is Marilyn great?
In Simpsonville, Kentucky. I'm just a bit east of Louisville.
Oh, okay. What can we do for Marilyn in the real home of the Simpsons in Kentucky?
Yeah. Well, I am a beekeeper, and we farmed for years, but we don't have all that property now, and we're down to 5 acres. And we thought we would like to put in about a half an acre of some sort of flower mix for the bees. I think I have a source that might be reliable to buy the seed. I've never purchased from them before. But more importantly, this area is in fescue, and fescue is tough. Especially what is in our area. And I'm thinking that plowing it up or turning it over might not be enough to kill it off. And I'm thinking that that's what's going to have to be done before we could get on with putting down seed.
You know, only a farmer would say we're down to 5 acres. So where are you getting this wildflower mix from?
It's in Ohio, actually. It's called Better Bee. They have several mixes that are available because, you know, the important thing is to find something that is useful to the bees. I mean, we could put in wildflowers, but it might not be what the bees find beneficial for them.
I'm so glad you brought this up because one important thing to know about wildflower mixes is they should really come from somebody who knows the plants in your region. Because otherwise, there have been situations where people have bought wildflower mixes through the mail that were meant for other parts of the country. And in those parts of the country, those would be well-behaved plants. But taking them to a different region, sometimes they become invasive or they just don't thrive. I would simply plow up the field. Most of these wildflowers grow best in relatively poor soil. So if you till up this fescue, which is itself a clumping grass and not a running grass, a couple of times, you'll knock back about half of it. And that's all you really want to do. Now, you want to get a wildflower mix that is as close as possible for your region. If you just look up online the USDA's Logan Bee Lab, they have all sorts of plant lists for all parts of the country. And those guys are the drop-dead experts. But I'll tell you that one of the things that is simplest is bee balm. You know, Minarda, which is going to bring in lots of butterflies, lots of bees. Is this area, does it drain well?
I'll tell you that the soil will be clay. And it is in an area that I wouldn't say that it necessarily drains well, but it will not be soggy either.
A couple of things you might not have thought of. Sunflowers. Sunflowers are bee candy, and they're very tough. Now, I'm not talking about the big oil sunflowers, although those are good as well. I'm talking about all kinds of ornamental sunflowers.
I'm familiar with that, and I've grown a lot of sunflower in patches in my life. I guess the thing with the sunflower is that we would have to keep sowing to keep it going for the season.
Not necessarily. If you grow enough of it, and at the end of the season, you just bust up the heads and throw them back down on the soil, they could be self-seeding. Either that or you just cut off the heads and you save the seeds yourself. That's pretty easy peasy. So I would say, you know, get in there with a very localized wildflower mix. I personally would go crazy with sunflowers. You got to put in some bee balm. And
the bee balm is a bit problematic where I live because of mildew. They really mildew quite rapidly.
Okay, well, then knock that off the list. But you're also going to learn that about some of the wildflowers, too. Some of them are going to do better than others.
Okay.
Some of them are going to naturalize. But just plow it up, sow the seed, level it out. And the best plants for bees are the ones that are going to tough it out in this situation.
Correct. Okay.
All right, good luck, Marilyn.
Thank you so much. Send
us some honey.
I'll send you some photos.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thanks.
And where is John Fine?
In Morristown, New Jersey.
Just across the bridge from Philadelphia.
Correct.
All right. What can we do for John in the Garden State?
Well, you know, it's been a very mild autumn, and I put my garden to bed. I rototilled it, and I put in my garlic 2 weeks ago, and it's all come up, much to my dismay.
First, I'll point out that you are more correct than you know. There was just a big national article that October and at least the beginning of November were the hottest, the warmest on record everywhere on the planet. But especially in parts of North America where we are. I mean, I can't remember having a warmer or more joyous October. Now, I'm going to yell at you. You ready?
Okay.
Why are you tilling your garden in the fall?
Well, it's just something I do. Maybe that's the wrong thing to do.
One of the things you must notice is that if you have areas that you till and areas that you don't till, that you have worse weed problems in the tilled up areas. And if you want to do that and then plant tomatoes the next year, that's on you. But as you should know, if you're an experienced garlic grower, it's like rhubarb and asparagus. Weeds are your worst enemies on a plant like that, because especially once the garlic is up, depending on the side of the bed, it can be really hard to get in there and weed, and then you're disturbing the roots. The idea when you have a nice raised bed system is to till it once, preferably in the spring, or double dig it or something like that. Get the soil nice and loose, level it out, and then water it every day. And then at the end of like 10 days or 2 weeks, use a very sharp hoe to slice the heads off all the little weeds that come up, and then never till that soil again, because if you don't step in it, it should not get compacted, and you shouldn't have to till it again.
Okay.
That's a secondary lesson. Garlic sprouting in the fall is far from a bad thing, because the above-ground growth that you have is super hardy. I mean, yes, some garlic does come from parts of the world that are Mediterranean, but a lot of the hardneck garlics that we especially like to grow in the Northeast, they're coming from like Siberia. They're coming from freezing cold climates. And frost will not harm their green shoots one bit. And the fact that you have green shoots above ground means that you have good root growth below ground. So even though sometimes, and I think every first timer or every person who plants garlic and has it sprout in the fall for the first time has a natural inclination to panic, what it means is you are going to get larger bulbs at the end of spring in early summer than someone whose garlic doesn't sprout until the spring, because your bulbs are already actively growing above ground and below ground. Now, if you want to do something to help the garlic and to prevent any weeds that you may have accidentally tilled up, what you certainly can do is after the soil freezes hard for the season, put an inch or two of well-shredded fall leaves over that bed. in between the garlic sprouts. That will insulate the soil. And what happens otherwise when you don't cover the soil is the soil freezes, then thaws, freezes and thaws over winter. And if we get a real roller coaster, a crazy one, it can sometimes push the garlic bulbs out of the ground. So by mulching the soil with well-shredded leaves, not whole ones, after the soil freezes hard, you keep it cold and you keep that soil temperature moderate. And that, again, will improve the size and the quality of the garlic you'll harvest in the summer. But the bottom line is nothing is wrong. This just means that your garlic is growing well and is extremely healthy.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate that.
Oh, I just love growing garlic. I love talking about it. Now, you know to cut the scapes off in the spring, right?
I do.
Okay. And then harvest when a third of the plants have turned brown.
Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. You're good to go, John. Enjoy your garlic around the 4th of July.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone out there the tickets to the famed Philadelphia Flower Show are free when you become a member of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, which you certainly can do at this ho-ho-ho time of year. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.org just yet, because we'll be right back with Strange Sweet Potatoes and more of your strange phone calls. I'm Strangely Sweet Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in the Question of the Week segment, are you sick of sweet potatoes yet? Well, what about those gaily colored sweet potato vines that are so popular in planters and hanging baskets? Did you know they make little tubers in the soil? We'll tell you what you can do with those tubers when we get to the Question of the Week. In the meantime, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, at 1-888-346-9499. Cheryl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just ducky today. And how is Cheryl's good. Where is Cheryl good?
Cheryl is good in South Central Arkansas, just a few miles north of the Louisiana line.
Oh, okay. So you're looking for mild winters most of the time, right?
Most of the time. We've got our first sunshiny, perfect day today after several days of rain. It's beautiful outside. and about 50 degrees.
Okay, good, good, good. Later on, we'll be battling ice storms. I'll be thinking of you. What can we do for Cheryl in Arkansas?
Well, the other day, I caught a piece of a caller to your show, and she had called asking you a question about ivy growing up the side of the house, which you discouraged. But you did tell her that pyracantha was a good option and that it was stunningly beautiful in the winter. She then, which I agree with you, we have pyracantha here, and it is. Its red berries are stunning in the winter. And she also asked you about birds and whether or not it attracted birds. Well, I'm not sure where the caller was from, but in our part of the country, every late winter, early spring, late February, early March into April, there are several of us that look forward to the cedar waxwings, also called bandit birds in this area, coming through and performing their annual feeding frenzy ritual, where they strip the pyracantha berries. In particular, they like ligustrum, and they like holly, and they like yaupon, and they like mandina. But the pyracantha are the real attraction, and I actually hear them before I see them, because the shadows, my office is in the home facing the grounds, and the shadows and the sounds, their high chirps will just flit across, and they're a joy to watch hanging on the and clustering on the pyracantha berries. So the further north these birds go, it's my understanding that they follow the food as they migrate north, and we don't see them around here during the summertime. So it may be that wherever your caller was from, there may not be they may not be so hungry, but they sure are hungry when they come through here, and they do feed on the pyracantha, and they can strip the pyracantha berries in no time flat.
Now, that's amazing. I remember this phone call. This was a very curious one, because the woman was immune to poison ivy, and she was growing it as a decorative vine, which I told her the founding gardeners used to do. Jefferson and Washington both loved the look of poison ivy, great fall color, and berries that attracted birds. And back in the colonial days, I don't think it mattered if you were handling something that gave most people a rash. I don't think anybody ever had clear skin back then. So you probably wouldn't notice a little bit more irritation. But she was doing the same thing. And if I recall correctly, was moving down south, was actually allergic to the true ivies, Boston ivy and the other
English ivy.
Yeah, which again I assured her was well known in Europe but little known over here as an allergy. So she wanted a vine to grow up the side of the house in her, I think she was moving down to the Carolinas, and I'm looking through my Southern gardening book, and I'm looking at Virginia creeper, and I'm looking at all these other vines. But then she kept repeating that the thing she loved most about the poison ivy was the birds coming in to strip the berries. And it was like a living bird feeder for her.
Right.
And for some reason, I flashed on pyracantha, which I see growing all over Center City, Philadelphia, because she also wanted a vine that had a lot of musculature over winter. Have a good look. And I think it's one of the most underutilized plants and must be pretty much easy, because every place I see it, it is magnificently old. I mean, the vine turns into a trunk. And the reason I only questioned, I didn't say that that birds don't eat it, but I wondered, because I would see the berries persist so long into winter. But then, of course, you don't notice when something's gone. And I imagine some of the same thing might have happened, which would make it an ideal situation, because you want the berries over winter when there's no other color around. But then once the spring bulbs come up and the roses pop off, birds can eat everything for all we care.
I have photographs of the cedar waxwings. I love catching them here. And I have photographs from March and April. And you're absolutely right. In this area, we will have jonquils and other things blooming, certainly by the time that the cedar waxwings come through. But you're right. It's very easy. I'm not exactly a gardener. our pyracantha is almost on its own, and I had to cut it back this year because it had gotten so pendulous over the drive. It's so old. I'm sure the builders planted it 50 years ago, and it's so old that it drooped too low for people to get in and out of the driveway. Other people here will use it, like you have suggested, and train it to go up a fireplace, for example, and it will have the red berries on it up into the late spring.
Yeah, and I've seen a version with orange berries as well.
Right, and I call them red, and they really are a fiery, orangey red, and they are stunning this time of year.
Oh, that is so great.
Thank you for letting me call you, and thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. Enjoy your cedar wax wings this coming spring.
We shall, and I will send you a picture if I catch them this year.
Excellent, excellent. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm glad you took my call.
I'm glad you made it, Richard. Where are you, sir?
Williamstown, New Jersey.
In the Garden State. What can we do for Richard?
Well, I moved from a beautiful house where I used to have raised beds that were built according to your specifications, but now I'm in a condo, and everything I have in the condo has to be in pots.
Right.
Because you're not allowed to plant anything in the ground. So I brought a few things in, including my dwarf orange tree and my pepper plants, but I don't know what to do about two of my potted plants. One is two of the pots are these nice bushy blueberries bushes. They've dropped their leaves. And two pots also have these, I'd say, 3 to 4 foot tall arborvitaes.
Right.
And what do I do with them in the wintertime? Do I bring them in? Do I cover them? What should I do with these plants? I just don't know what to do since they're potted.
Well, you certainly did the right thing with the orange and the pepper plants. They needed to come inside, and I hope they're getting bright light inside.
Yep, they're in the southern facing part of the condo.
Okay.
They're happy.
Okay, so blueberries have what's called a chilling requirement. They do need to go through winter. Luckily for you, they are also extraordinarily cold hardy. The original blueberries, the Native American blueberries, come from the most far northern parts of our country and into Canada as well. So they can take a good chill. What is their pot made of?
They're very large terracotta-type pots.
Okay, they got to come out of the terracotta because the terracotta is going to crack and split open when the wet soil inside freezes and unfreezes.
Okay.
And there's no place you're allowed to put anything in the ground, or the plant police are going to, like, come after you?
Yeah, they've already yelled at me for having too many potted plants.
Oh, man, did you pick the wrong place. Well, I hate to tell you this, but you got to get them out of the terracotta. Put the terracotta in some storage place. Ideally, if you can just go to a garden center now, they'd be thrilled to see anybody buying gardening supplies instead of inflatable Homer Simpson Santa Clauses.
Yeah.
So see if you can get a plastic pot that's around the same size.
Okay.
And then just turn your terracotta pot on its side. Try to wiggle the whole thing out without disturbing the root ball. Put it in the plastic pot and then... you know, can you roll it up against the side of your house somewhere?
You mean, yeah, I can put it right against the side of that. I have it. Where they're sitting right now is in front of the patio door.
Right. If you could roll it up against the side of your house and then cover it with shredded leaves, that would be ideal. And I would say that the arborvitae might even be able to come inside. It's an evergreen. It's a conifer. It survives winter. I don't know that it needs winter. You might be able to, like, fake bonsai the thing, at least to buy a year. But then I would keep it in a cool spot, but give it bright light as if it were outside.
Right. Well, that would work. I have an entranceway that has the windows on both sides of the doors that go all the way to the floor.
Right.
I could bring them inside and put them on both of those, each one on each side of that.
So that would be...
It's also southern exposure.
That would be coolish but bright.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would look really nice in your entryway. Make sure they don't get too dried out, you know, because the indoor air does get dry in winter. Right. But don't overwater them. bright light and cool. And then your two options for the blueberries are, like I said, transfer them to big plastic pots, turn them on their side, push them up against the house and hide them with some shredded leaves. Or even if you have a friend who still has a regular house, just drive them over there, drop the plastic pots into a hole in the ground, and then bring them back to your place in the spring.
Oh, that sounds good. Okay, fantastic. I will follow your advice.
All right, good luck, Richard.
Thank you very much.
Take care, man.
You too now.
1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Rick. Where are you, sir?
Bucks County, up in the Warwick area, just north of Philly.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Rick in Bucks County?
Just a general question, Mike. We moved into a new home about a year and a half ago, and of course the lawn and some of the things outside were not put in, you know, over the years. So we have a little challenge with the lawn. Got some pebbles and things after they put in the driveway, and maybe a little green netting is really what separates whatever grass we have from the actual construction material, which is, you know, the dark yellow material rather than, you know, sod or something like that. So I wanted to make sure it's going to get into having a nice lawn, whether it's fescue, rye, or soysia, whatever you recommend.
Mm-hmm.
But right now it's just rather thin.
Yeah, rarely do they put in a nice lawn. Rarely do they put it in at the right time of year. Now, you're in Bucks County in Pennsylvania,
yes,
which means most people would have a cool season lawn.
Mm-hmm.
That would be bluegrass or the most sustainable lawn for your region,
mm-hmm,
for our region, is what's called mm-hmm turf-type tall fescue. But lately, they've been blending that with different species of bluegrass that they mm-hmm claim to have dwarfed, so to speak. So it's very
mm-hmm
slow growing. The other possibility would be zoysia grass, which is a warm mm-hmm season grass, very mm-hmm durable, very slow growing. It doesn't need to be fed. You only cut it once or twice a year, but it does mm-hmm turn tan and go dormant during the cold months.
Mm-hmm.
So do you care about that part?
We like to keep it, you know, fairly green during the year. So it sounds like maybe the fescue bluegrass might be the best combination.
Okay. Now, are we talking
yes
about a big area?
Not at all. A very nice small front lawn.
Oh,
the back
okay
is fine. But
okay,
a rather small area. It's a 3,200 square foot home, but a nice small lawn in the front.
Okay. Well, you have an excellent option then in the springtime. You have some really outstanding independent garden centers out where
yeah
you are. And I'd mm-hmm start talking to them and inquiring mm-hmm as to what kind of sod they have available mm-hmm in the spring and mm-hmm start to arrange it. Now, what you'll mm-hmm do, when you start with sod, it's like laying carpet, man. You don't have to worry about putting down seed and it sprouting and keeping it moist or anything like that. You know, when
mm-hmm
you when you lay a good quality sod, it's your game to lose.
Yeah.
So what you would yeah do in the spring, you would want to know when they get the sod in. Freshness is everything. It's just like produce or milk or meat.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh sod is the best. What you do is you'll have somebody come out professionally, measure the height of what you have mm-hmm now. And typically what will happen is your old grass and some of the old soil will have to be removed because
mm-hmm
the sod comes in with a good amount of dirt packed around its roots and it has mm-hmm a good height of its own. They'll lay it like a carpet. And then your responsibility, according to what Nick Christians told me years ago, he's our turf grass expert from Iowa State University, is you water the heck out of it for like 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stay off of it and you don't water it for a while,
mm-hmm,
like a
mm-hmm
week. And okay that will reinvigorate it. The roots will grow down into your subsoil. And then after that, it's just a question of always making sure there's 3 inches of green left after you cut it. And if we go through a drought, especially the first year, because it's going to be like a new tree, it's going to be a new plant. If we have a drought, and with an area this small, actually, it's easy peasy, you want to give it a good multi-hour soaking once a week during the summer if we don't any week we don't get rain. But I wouldn't even bother to feed it the first year because it's already going to come to you, you know, having been fed quite luxuriously. Yeah. For a small area, and especially when you want to get it done in the spring, that's when the highest quality sod is around in Pennsylvania. It's more expensive than seed, but it's one-tenth the time and energy, and it's an instant lawn.
Great, great.
All right, Rick.
That's wonderful, Mike. No, I really appreciate that. And then I'll take on the shrubs next. We got a couple of azaleas that are doing well after the first year, but I may look at like you know, some Japanese maple or something that's a little bit hardier.
Okay, good. Well, the azaleas should be very hardy. Just make sure their soil stays acidic. A mulch of milled peat moss with compost is what they like the most.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your information, and I really enjoy your show. Thank you.
All right. Congratulations on your new house, too, Rick.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will light the electrical spectacle Christmas lights in Philadelphia's Franklin Square at 6th and Arch Streets on Wednesday evening, December 23rd. That's Christmas Eve Eve. I'll ignite and reignite those lights every half hour from 4:30 until 6 o'clock, giving me plenty of time in between to talk about your gardening problems with you. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with some strange sweet potatoes and more of your strange phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will talk about those incredibly popular sweet potato vines that people use to decorate their planters and hanging baskets, and the useful material that may be lurking, perhaps even unseen, in the soil underneath. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I love your show.
Why, thank you, Dave. I love that you love the show. Where are you, man?
Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia.
And the home of a famous radio station of my youth. That's where, at least in back in the old days, WIBG used to be located, one of the great top 40 rock and roll stations of the 50s and 60s.
Oh, wow. And were you a top 40 disc jockey?
No, I was a little kid listening to rock and roll in a Bakelite radio, Dave. I'm not that old. Don't give me any decades I haven't earned yet, you know. All right, what can we do for Dave in Lafayette Hill?
Well, I have a tale of two compost piles, and they're kind of at opposite ends of the success spectrum here, but they both need a little professional help from someone such as yourself. The first one is our tumbler. Now, we got a 65-gallon compost tumbler thinking that this would really speed up the process, and we would really be able to make more compost in less time, and I'd be able to seal even more of our neighbor's leaves. And that was over a year ago. That was about 14 months ago, and the things that I put in that tumbler look the same now as they did when I put them in there. There isn't anything even remotely composty happening in that tumbler.
Two problems with those big turning tumbler bins. One of them is they don't have ground contact. One of the things we really don't see that really helps our compost along when it's just in a open pile or a bin, earthworms can come and go freely. So when the weather is nice, and especially when the compost is fresh, earthworms are going in there. And then when the compost gets too hot or it gets too cold, they can go back in the ground. And in the spring, they'll come back up. And it's really like having an outdoor worm bin. They really help move the contents along. The other part of the tumbler is that because they're a sealed unit, you actually have to think about getting rainwater or other water into them, or the contents will get too dry. You know, there's more involved. It is harder to keep the moisture levels right, and you don't get no worms. And I would never advise anybody to actually try to force earthworms into a compost tumbler. They need to be able to move up and down in the soil. But if you get the moisture levels right and the leaves are well shredded and there's some nitrogen-rich material in there like coffee grounds, and you turn it, it does make compost well. It sounds like probably your main problem is you haven't been wetting the material.
Okay.
All right, now what's wrong with your other pile?
Well, the other pile is actually the leaves that were waiting to get in the tumbler all this time. Just sitting there on the ground, they composted just fine all by themselves. If I may say so myself, it looks like a really nice, well-done compost pile. And in fact, the plants like it so much that they haven't waited for me to spread it around on the flower beds. They've sprouted right up there in the pile.
As soon as you see that, as soon as you see these little sprouts coming out of the pile, which are probably like vegetable seeds and stuff that maybe you mixed in, just get a hoe and knock them down when they're small. If you think about it, it's a little bit like sprouted grains. Those fresh sprouts mixed back into the compost have a lot of vital plant energy in them. But nature tried to learn you there, Dave, of being exposed to the elements and with the invisible earthworms coming and going in your pile, that created a much more natural system. I think one of the big advantages to having the spinning compost or the compost tumblers is you can put kitchen waste in there, and because they tend to be metal or hard plastic and are sealed, you don't have to worry about vermin.
Okay. Well, now this, I guess I should say then that the outdoor pile really occupies the space where it was once, I've been told that it's Pachycandra. It's a sort of a ground covering plant. Most of which I pulled up before I designated that spot as the compost pile.
Okay.
And that's most of what has come back up through the pile. In fact, most of the pile is really like one big root ball of the roots for this plant.
Okay, so
Is that still worthy of the hoe strategy? Should I just go at it with the...
Yeah. Well, no, what you should do now is you got to start forking that stuff into a wheelbarrow, taking it over to the compost tumbler, and turning it so you burn up the Pachycandra, or else all your garden beds, your raised beds, are going to grow Pachycandra for you in the future.
Yes, that's what I was afraid of. Okay.
All right, Dave has something to occupy his time with, and it'll build muscle, and it'll be good aerobic exercise, Dave.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right, good luck, sir. 1-888-346-9499. Tim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Yes, this is Tim.
How are you, Tim?
I'm good, and I'm really curious to see what you have to say about how I should be transplanting trees little saplings and also how to plant trees properly in general.
Oh, okay. And where are you, Tim?
I am located in Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. So
that's correct.
What's going on? Are you taking trees from one part of your property to another? Are you moving them out of the wild into your landscape? What's going on here?
I'm taking trees from somebody's property and transplanting them on mine. And what I'm after are black walnut trees or walnut trees in general. You can't buy them at stores. So I have to drive around in the neighborhood and look for little saplings. People think they're growing in the garden and they usually treat them as weeds and cut them out. But I'd like to get my hands on them so I can transplant them into my yard. And I'm looking to transplant six. And I've already transplanted 10, and so far only one survived out of 10. So I'm definitely doing something wrong when I'm transplanting these trees.
And when did you commit this 11 out of 12 homicide? What time of year?
This was in the springtime.
Oh,
so
okay.
Things are blooming. They look great. They're tiny little things, maybe 1 to 2 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I pull them out or dig them out as best as I can. Bring them home and stick them in a little hole I dug with potting soil around them.
Okay, that's a mistake.
Oh, see, I knew I'm doing more than one thing wrong.
Now, Tim, you mystify me. Why do you like black walnuts? I mean, for most of us, they're tomato killers.
There's several reasons. I'm planting about 20 fruit and nut trees on my property as part of my retirement plan so I can go to my backyard instead of the supermarket.
But
and
you
pick fresh fruit and nuts.
You realize these are not the walnuts that you buy in the supermarket.
Right. And the other part of that is the black walnuts are for the squirrels because my wife raised two squirrels from babies. We have a little squirrel feeder outside our second story window that they come to
You're
every
evil
morning.
Evil people. Why should I help you? Those squirrels are servants of Satan. They exist only to destroy gardens.
Well, some people like them, some people don't, yes.
All right, so here's the deal.
Okay.
Spring is okay. Believe it or not, this is actually a better time of year to move plants as long as the soil isn't frozen.
Okay.
You want your receiving hole to be wide but not deep. You want to plant these things high in the ground. And you want to plant them in an area that drains well. Black walnuts will grow in any kind of soil, but there are very few trees that can handle a constantly wet soil, and black walnuts, you know, are among the trees that will not tolerate it. What you would do, you would probably, if the saplings are 1 or 2 feet tall, you've probably noticed they have a fairly serious root system.
Yes, because I tried 4-foot trees first. Oh, my God, the roots 4 foot deep.
Yes, exactly. You might be looking for even smaller saplings. And the idea is, ideally, to get some help. And you get shovels down into the ground, starting about 2 feet out from the trunk, is where you want to put your shovels down into the ground. And then you make a circle around to where the shovels meet. And then very slowly, you keep working the soil. And your goal is to pop out an island of soil.
Okay.
If you can't see many roots at all, then you have essentially a potted plant that's going to do very well.
I got you.
If you sever over a third of the roots, the plant's never going to survive.
Okay.
Now, this giant root ball will weigh quite a bit, like a live Christmas tree. So the idea is to have a tarp handy and a couple of people, and then you roll the root ball onto the tarp and then put it in the truck or whatever, you know, you're going to take it to where you're going.
Yes.
And then plant it no deeper than it was in its native soil in completely unamended soil. It was growing in regular soil, and that's where it's going to grow. If you do that, if you bring home a big dirt ball, so to speak, you plant the tree high, and then you make sure it's watered. If we have a dry spell, there's no reason you shouldn't have a black walnut forest.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right, Tim.
Thank you, Mike.
Good luck, squirrel lover.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it is time for the question of the week. Grow your own sweet potato vines. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's oh-so-intriguing question.
Absolutely, Mike. Candy in Port Murray, New Jersey, which she explains is near the Delaware Water Gap.
Wait a minute. How can there be a gap in the Delaware water? You mean like the Red Sea thing? What's going to happen to little fishies? Do you expect them to walk across this gap? What is wrong with...
All right. We heard you. Candy in Port Murray, New Jersey writes, I recently pulled out a decorative sweet potato vine when I cleaned out my planters for the season and found huge tubers under the soil.
I'm worried about the fishies.
I understand that they are not the tastiest kinds of sweet potatoes, but I would like to save them to plant again in the spring. What's the best way to store them for the winter? And should I cut them apart in the spring and bury the pieces in my planters?
I can't believe you're mean to fish. I'm so amazed. Anyway, a strong no to the cutting apart for planting. That is the advice commonly given for, quote, regular potatoes, like the buttery, delicious Yukon Gold and other gourmet varieties. But one, I plant my seed potatoes whole. I find that cutting them into pieces greatly increases the chance of their rotting, especially in the cold, wet soil of spring. And two, sweet potatoes are not even remotely related to regular potatoes, and their propagation is very different. In fact, as far as I know, it's pretty unique in the world of edible plants.
Right. Haven't you said that sweet potatoes are related to morning glories?
Weird but true. My huge plant book, which is a poor man's version of Hortus, because I'm a poor man, explains that the genus is essentially a family of around 300 different vines from mostly tropical parts of the world. It includes the familiar morning glory, so named because its flowers open early in the day, its fragrant cousin, the moonflower, whose blooms open up in the evening, and the sweet potato, which is itself a kind of vine, but one that's always left to sprawl on the ground, which, you know, morning glories would also do if you didn't give them anything to climb up on.
And the ornamental sweet potato vines that have gotten so popular in planters and hanging baskets are just a variety of sweet potato, right? One thing that seems certain about them is that they all seem to grow crazy-looking tubers in the soil. We have gotten a ton of emails and phone calls from people who find strangely colored treasures when they clean out their planters at the end of the season, mostly asking if these things are safe to eat.
Which they are. It's like Candy said, they just tend not to taste real good. The really weird part is that the people we hear from who tried to grow regular sweet potatoes almost always either failed or got tubers the size of a walnut. While these ornamental vines always seem to deliver a huge harvest. Makes me wonder if we shouldn't be growing all of our sweet potatoes in hanging baskets.
Seriously? Why would that help?
Well, the leaves of plants in hanging baskets can collect a lot more solar energy than the leaves on a vine that's earthbound because they're not going to pile up on top of each other.
Okay. Now, can she grow new vines from this year's tubers?
I suspect the answer is yes. They're weirdly shaped and strangely colored, but they're still sweet potatoes, so their propagation should be the same. But first she has to store them correctly.
Wouldn't you just keep them in a cool, dark place like regular potatoes?
Eventually. But first, the experts recommend that you cure them, a mystical enterprise where they're exposed to heat and humidity both in the 90s for a week. Then they go into the cool, dry place.
Ooh, it sounds kind of treacherous.
You know, I agree, and that's why I'm going to suggest that she only cure half of her harvest and store the other half normally, and then see which ones slip better in the spring.
Slipping is when you grow little baby plants out of a whole sweet potato.
Yeah, it's easy and fun. It's one of the best gardening things you can do with kids. Now, all of the members of this plant family are really frost sensitive, so you want to wait to start slipping your tubers until it's about 2 weeks before your last frost date in the spring.
Then I know. You put one end of a whole tuber into a jar of water with toothpicks shoved into its sides to keep it from falling in, right?
You know, that's what you see on all the kindergarten shelves, but I'm not really sure it grows the best sweet potato slips. The pros say to bury the tuber about halfway to three-quarters in a container of sand and keep the sand wet. Green slips will sprout from the sides and top of the tuber. After they reach about 6 inches in height, you gently pluck them off, and then you plant them in very loose, rich, non-chilly soil, or in our listener's case, into a hanging basket or container. The nice thing about only being interested in these vines is that it takes a good 100 days to get decent-sized tubers from regular sweet potatoes planted in a garden bed, and that's in a season with a warm spring and a good summer.
But the vines slip into sight right away.
Well, that sure was some bizarre information about a really strange family of plants, now wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who are not already overwhelmed with sweet potatoes during this hectic holiday season, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with a link to another sweet potato article that explains why they're not yams either, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to give my slips the slips if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location. And where you will find the answers to that email question you were going to send us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Please check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website sweet as a sweet potato. Alexis Landis wears a slip and produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Al Banks is our editor, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Slippery Stephen Drehobel is our ace production assistant. Gum slip sliding away, Mike McGrath, but I will slide on back again to see you again next week. What's the secret to keeping a rosemary Christmas tree alive? Are Norfolk pines really from Virginia? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal some realities about holiday plants you need to know. Plus your fabulous phone calls.